I'm L. Sawyer, and I'll start with a little bit of this quote. It's a very, very interesting quote, and I think it's poignant for this conversation, at least to me. For every new world makes for a new worldview, makes for a new brain. I have been home 20 years as of January, this past January. And I think this quote is going to come up a lot, just if you just hold that in your head about, you know, adaptation and how natural adaptation is and how it should be expected. But that's a there's a process for that happening. I would see my process of reentry, and I would word my process of reentry, one of mental healing, and one of unconscious resilience building, and I'll explain. I was fortunate to meet a filmmaker while I was in prison. It was a happenstance meeting, but I was more fortunate that I had elders in the institution that taught me about networking, the importance of networking, and how to be an asset to a network. I often talk about a time when I had about 2 years in prison, and I was stabbed while I was in prison. I had a son at the time, and I was very clear about the fact that I didn't think I was going to come home. Very clear. So my thought at the time, you know, I was in prison, right? Like, I didn't get visits like that. Nobody in my family had Collect on their phone. That's out. You can call. Just don't call Collect. That's a fact. So I was in prison, for real. So I had a son. So calling my son for a 5-minute phone call, and he's 3 years old, for $20 at the time, that wasn't happening. His grandma graciously allowed for me to have phone calls with him every 2 or 3 months. My mom would get cards. I would get once or twice. I would get birthday cards from my mom, see my mom once every other year or so. She did what she could do. So I was in prison. And I make that statement because I need people to understand about this new world and the new worldview. Makes for a new brain. The idea is that when you're in prison, you're corded off from society. And I think that gets disillusioned a little bit, right? Of people that don't quite understand what it means to be institutionalized unintentionally. I was stabbed in my cell. Didn't think I was going to go home. I had this harebrained scheme that I was going to come up with. Work my way inside the institution. It was an internal video crew. And my plan was to work my way onto this internal video crew. And they had big VHS cameras. They went around and documented whatever programs were going on in the institution and put it on an internal LAN service system so people could see about who's, you know, openings in the barbershop or whatever, all this kind of jazz. You talk trash, but you was watching those shows too, right? Anyway, so I got on the internal video crew, and that was a task because Greater Ford at the time had the biggest number of people serving life or numbers equivalent in the state. Pennsylvania had the biggest number in the country, and America had the biggest in the world. Everybody on that video crew had a life sentence or the numbers equivalent, so there was no opening. So they allowed little old me to come and wrap wires, and I did that graciously. I'm still the best wire wrapper you can imagine. I showed up early, did what I needed to do. As long as I got my hand on that camera and I could send tapes home, and I did. I sent 10 tapes home to my son, projecting myself into the future in a way that was dignified, that I felt like whatever. And this was literally equivalent to a suicide note. While I was on the video crew doing this, for those reasons only, a filmmaker was coming into the institution, following an artist that was doing work in the institution. In that process, they told the filmmaker that he was not allowed, he's allowed to come, but he wasn't allowed to bring a film crew with him. So if he wanted to use, if he wanted to film anything, he had to use the internal video crew. He said, okay, but y'all don't have any filmmakers. And he was like, well, too bad. You know, this is what you got. They asked us who wanted to do it. Nobody wanted to do it. I raised my hand. It's my opportunity to touch the camera in a legit way. So I did. That was life-changing, to say the least. This guy, beautiful, beautiful human being, Glenn Holston, did not look like me, won't from where I'm from, had no social connection to this guy whatsoever. I've never met a Glenn in my life up until that point. I don't think I still met a Glenn, but all I'm saying is that no way, shape, or form in the world, in my mind's world that I created, that I stepped into, that I had adapted to, Glenn didn't exist. So the novelty of going to see him is one thing, but sustaining that relationship, oh, this can't last. It was too much work. I'd much rather be on a weight pile with my friends, with my homies. I'd much rather sit in my cell and I don't know what I was doing, but I didn't want to go down there with him. It was taxing to interact with him, if y'all can understand that, right? And I don't know if y'all ever been in a situation where you had to interact with somebody that possessed power. Power. And they're from a different cultural structure than you. And they're from a, in that context, a dominant structure. And you had to jump through hoops outside of who you are to make this person like you. Think about that. That's never talked about. I didn't want to do it. I said, I'm cool. I had elders. Harun, Daoud's son is here. And his grandson is actually right. His grandson is right here filming, right here. Daoud just came home. He was 46 years, and he just came home. These dudes walk on water to me, man. I would try my hardest to go to the yard or stay in my cell, and they would be right there posted up. What are you doing? Come on. And escort me at times down there to see that guy. Not only physically, it wasn't a physical, no. They created a social system that allowed me to make mistakes. That allowed me to be where I am. And they met me where I was. They understood me not only culturally, but psychologically. How many people in here have services? You ain't got a raise no hand. You got all these services and people, oh, I guess they just don't want it. How many people do, you ain't got a raise, right? All they gotta do is just come down. We got all this free stuff. I can plug them right in. I guess they don't want it. What did I just say? That was me. That was me. And listen, I had no other alternative. My family is not well. My community is not well. Deep poverty. I was celebrated for selling drugs at 12 years old. My mom gave me the big piece of chicken about that. And that's real, right? We don't talk about that. The only way I could get my little sister to come visit when she did is because I promised her I'm about to bust a move when I go home. I sat on a visit like, yeah, what's the prices again? No, goodness well, I couldn't tell her I'm going to do film. Lied to her all my whole time. That's my support system. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about that at all. Right? I remember walking around the yard with Harun. And we would do these walks. Obviously, this is what, you know, this is the process. This is feeding me, right? In a sense of just like letting me know and making me understand the totality of who Glenn was and how to leverage that resource and play a role within that resource. And Daoud's role was, let me know not to forget about my community. That was his whole jam. He said, when you look in the mirror, don't see yourself, see your community. That was what he said. And I carry that now. I remember one time I was walking around the yard and I told Haroon, I said, you know what, Room? Something's going on with me, man. He said, what? I said, between me and you, and this is between us too, by the way, so don't. I trust you. Oh, good people here. Except for Rob. I said, Room, I talk to myself. Like excessively. Like I'm talking about, I got a whole movie going on in my head. At all times. Like legit, at all times. How many people in here heard about people in prison having daydreams, excessive daydreams? Raise your hand, if you don't mind. Now, how many people in here work with or connected to people that were in prison or are currently in prison? So everybody's hand should be raised with respect to people having daydreams. If you don't know that, we got to talk. Check in with me, and I can give you a list of folks we need to talk to about that. That's a specific pathology connected to incarceration. But we'll talk about that. There's this quote from this amazing author, and his name's John Henrik Clark. Anybody know John Henrik Clark? Raise your hand. There we go. Come on now. Right? There you go. John Henrik Clark says, it's your duty to take your life experience and all your skills and fashion it into a tool of liberation. I live by that. I'm all about that. My role is, how do I take my skill sets, my lived experience, and leverage it for exposure? Not only for myself, and this is what film was. It's exposure and to expose. When I came home, as tough as it was, as mind-bending tough as it was, I fell on my face 15,000 ways. Easy, 15. I told myself, even before I came home, that once I got introduced to film, I told myself that what did I need, right, in prison? I thought, what did I need? What's lacking? What did I need? And I told you about the lack of information that was coming into the institution, right? Like for me, right? Like limited family connection, because, I mean, how valid was, you know, is that information? Because all we're going to talk about is selling drugs anyway, so I, you know, we ain't talking about that. But I had TV. That's not really helpful at all. Radio, right? Newspaper, maybe. We didn't have a lot of access to outside information that helped me formulate a viable plan for when I came home, to my home. Not a program with somebody from out in Bucks County somewhere that put together a joint that done told me about going to Big Kmart and all of that, or told me about, you know, what a formal setting in a dining room is and all of that. No. I'm talking about a real imagery about where I was coming home to and so many folks was coming home to. Whether you was in the hood or out in this, in the country somewhere, right? Like either way, poverty is poverty. And you're gonna look and, you know, so in mind's eye, I needed to make a product. I needed to make a film that represented where I was going home to. Not just for me to do it. It was, again, leveraging it as a tool for liberation. My thought at the time was people needed to see and make a plan based off of where they were coming home to. Like, this is Pull of Gravity. That film was important. It was so important to me. And that film, let me just say, that film is 10 years old. That ain't no new film. You would think that was right now on 10, that's in 10th and Cumberland. 10th and Cumberland, 12th and Hunterdon, that's my neighborhood, right? Right? We interviewed 15 people for that film. 15. 10 years later, 11 of them are dead. All by gunshots. on basically one intersection in Philly. I never thought, this is my family. This is straight up my family. So I watched this film as even rough and whatever as it is, you know, for as a memorial. And it is interesting because I haven't seen nothing to really even take its place in 10 years. It feels like it's in a vacuum when things have gotten worse. And I'm sitting there, wow, I can play this right now in any place that I go, and people be like, wow, that's going on. No, it been going on. And it was going on way before that. Exposure, right? So again, using film as a way to expose people to a life and a reality that people just don't know anything about. And they should know about it. How do we live in a country where this is a reality? How is that even possible? And how are we tooling people in prison to come back to that? How are we, what program we got to do that? Like legit. Because if we don't, we're missing a whole segment about what they're about to get hit in the head with. Everybody got their little plan and carrying on and, you know. I call it the book of life. Anybody here was in the penitentiary, y'all know what I'm talking about. Everybody had a plan. And they hold on to that, John. Nonsense. Because it ain't built on nothing. Right? And then resources that you receive, you going back there, ain't no resources there. It's just not. So, sorry, I go on tangent. That film meant a lot to me, not only for exposure for other folks, but exposure for me. That film gave me a platform to basically travel around. And Charlotte did a good job of, she literally, I met Charlotte. Charlotte drugged me by my earlobe across this country. I mean, excuse me, across the state. Rob didn't drive me, drove across the country. That's a different conversation. But then we started to screen abroad in other countries. I started doing work in Holland. I started speaking Dutch. Exposure. What's possible? I'm the same dude that didn't want to go down to see how, didn't want to go see Glenn. But what was the differentiation? The adapter? The adapter was someone that knew me, understand me, and where I was, that allowed me to. That was weak in Dutch. And I'm doing work all over the world. Have been doing work all over the world, all over the country. We do work, for, you name it, we're doing it. Work with Oprah and on and so on. For somebody that still can marginally read and write. Going into the prison, I didn't know how to read and write. Right? There shouldn't be an opportunity for someone like me if you take the standard course. Right? But what was the deciding factor? Again, access and an applicator. Right? It was somebody that literally got me, that understood me, that applied, that for me to then understand how to apply myself to an opportunity. It wasn't just plainly the opportunity. I was at a ballet with Rob and the wonderful Julie. I meet a financier, a friend of the family, named from New York. His name's Rod Burrow. You know, Julie and Rob is introducing me. And Rod says, hey, you know, I'm on the board of a music conservatory in New York. And the music conservatory in New York started this new program looking at music therapy. Would I be interested in doing a film on music therapy for veterans? I said, sure. Since I don't know anything about trauma, the only trauma I had understood or knew about was through trauma-informed care, which is amazing to get exposed to. But that wasn't going to get me into this film. This film was about deeply rooted, traumatized, injured service folks that came home from the U.S. military. And so for a year and a half of the film took 6 years to do. Now, at this time, I'm knee deep in reentry work, right, Charlotte? Like, I'm with it. So I'm at conferences, I'm doing everything reentry or social justice in this realm. I get in this Music Vets, is the name of the film, Music Vets. I get involved in this film, Music Vets. And for a year and a half, me and my company would get really intensive trauma training, like brain science trauma training. And we did UC Berkeley and Holland, we did in New York, all over. And it was game changing. Just blew me away. But for the whole time, it was still objective. I'd be like, wow, that's interesting. Nothing to do with me, but that's awesome. You know, that's, you know. It wasn't until we did a screening at the Kennedy Center. And it was in partnership with the military, you know, with the Department of Defense and, you know, Sound Health Network, which is this big conglomerate of, like, neuroscientists and all this kind of stuff, whatever, musicians. And we did this, the screening for it, premiere for it at the Kennedy Center in D.C. Rob came to that, too. And it wasn't until I was on the panel, and this is 6 years later, in this past October, that we was on the panel, and they talked about, and they was asking me a question, and all I kept referring to was myself. About my own trauma. And I'm sitting there like, so you, and again, understanding this, I'm 20 years home. So I'm well removed. The camera in my brain was a sort of wedge in between me and the trauma that I, you know, experienced. You know, you compartmentalize it, you put it in a box until that box gets knocked over or whatever. That took me on a whole thought process. Again, through all this process, there was this article that came out in 2019. It came across my feed, and I looked at it and kind of put it away or whatever. This article was about these 9 researchers. There's a Harvard study that they were sending 9 researchers. They wanted, so it started off as them trying to look at this, the exposure to solitary confinement and how solitary confinement changes your brain. They're just researching. But it was, they couldn't get an IRB. It wasn't ethical to put somebody going into solitary confinement in an MRI prior to and then after. That would be weird. So they thought about a whole nother way about, you know, going about capturing the data. This was a little bit different, where they basically took these 9 researchers that were going to Antarctica, and they they put them all through an MRI and did blood work and all. After a month of being there in the Antarctica, now mind you, they had, you know, creature comforts, right? Like they could work out. They weren't alone. They weren't in solitary confinement. Uniformly, everyone had, within a month, had 40% decrease volume in their hippocampus. 40%. They were there for 14 months, right? Which is normal, right? So think about this as a normal process. What does a hippocampus do, right? So a hippocampus, you don't get me going on this, Rob, because I'm not, you know, whatever. But, right? So your limbic system, I'm going to give it a little bit, right? So here's the quick and dirty, if you will. Your limbic system is your sort of behavioral and your sort of sensory socialization sort of zone in your brain. You have the two major parts of that is your amygdala. Another major part is your hippocampus. The amygdala is sort of like your trigger. So again, if your amygdala is inflamed based off of traumas, past traumas, that's like your trigger. If you have a hippocampus, your hippocampus works in conjunction with that, and your hippocampus is your sort of memory bank or like your memory file. So hippocampus deals with your spatial recognition, right? So if you're in a place like Antarctica over an extended period of time, your hippocampus will grow or shrink based off the size of your environment. If you're in your house during COVID, this was a big thing during COVID too, like long COVID and people that was, you know, stationed in place or whatever you call that, where, you know, you're in your house and there's a noise down the hall. You'd be like, oh, that's just little Johnny. You know what little Johnny is because you have recognition of that. You have a memory of that. In this case, where someone is isolated although they're not solitary isolation, they're as a group, their brains still fit to the size of that environment. That's what they know, the norms of that environment. That's all well and good. Nobody in this whole study, you know, identified any, you know, signs of depression or nothing. It didn't even know anything was going on. Nothing. Until they came home. Without knowing it, nobody told them what was going on, nothing. They came home. Up until a month or so after they go home, I'm paraphrasing, but I could look into it. It's like a month or so after they came home, their brain, their hippocampus atrophied another 10%. Within a year of the nine people, four self-identified as deeply depressed, and two contemplated suicide. Now, take that for whatever it's worth. I seen this and I says, you know what? Although there's a lot of conversations about prison and with respect to, you know, solitary confinement, how your brain changes based off solitary confinement. But this opened my mind up to saying, how does prison change your brain? How does that closed world? And I told you, I didn't have access to my family, didn't have access to outside stimuli. And part of the issue is when you have a mundane existence and environment, right? Not enough stimulation. Your brain is meant to grow and learn and involve with people, hear stories. That's how you grow. It's how you learn. My work on Music Vets, one of the biggest therapies of all the therapy is just being with people, not being alone. It's a knee-jerk reaction, trauma, to isolate. No, be a, you know, socialization. That's why COVID hit folks with PTSD and other, what they call, comorbid issues so hard. I mean, the idea is that they were isolated. In prison is social isolation 101. So in my head, I'm thinking, okay, what happens when you have hippocampus atrophy? Right? And there's a whole list, and I don't want to mention them all just because I don't want to pathologize anybody's condition, but we can understand how this will affect you. I mean, I hope you can. I mean, in the sense of, you know, social isolation, right? The idea is like when you transition home from prison, the idea is that there's a process in which you need to take a moment to be able to adjust to this new world. And again, you, new world makes for a new worldview, makes for a new brain, legitimately a new brain. So when people are coming home, when they came home from Antarctica, they weren't institutionalized. There was no, I'm projecting here, but they didn't have a sense of learned powerlessness like you do when you're in prison. Just the rules and the rule-bound environment creates a powerless class of people. They call it a, I hate to use the word, right? What's the word? Inmate. Because ain't nobody an inmate. That's first. That's a legit designation that creates learned powerlessness, period. And then you are a re-entrant. If you notice, in my whole conversation here, I never mentioned any of those two words, but I'm quoting in this context. These are human beings. When you identify and when you other folks, they internalize that, especially after a long extended period of exposure to institutionalization or what they call prisonization. That's real. Can you go to the next slide? This was Department of, Health and Human Services. Psychological impact of incarceration, implication for post-prison adjustment. Oh, if you ain't read this, this is a read for you. I ain't read Uncle Tom's Cabin, but I read this. And you want to talk about my experience and so many other people's experience? Go no further than your local government. And don't take my word. This ain't all yapping. This is. I can paraphrase. I want y'all to sit with that. And then I quit. And you know when this came out? 2001. 2001. Now there's updated stuff that speaks to the traumas of reentering, based off of prisonization and the lack of adaptation. The lack of support in that adaptation. That's what it's about. With that said, reentry is traumatic, especially if you're not made aware. What would it hurt to say, yo, L, check this out? I had to go to my old heads. When I went to my old head, Haroon, I told him, say, yo, bro, I'm talking to myself. He laughed and said, you gotta go a little bit crazy to stay sane. Do you know what that is? There's a designation for that. It's called dissociation disorder. The only time that's been studied is with childhood traumas and neglect. Not with grown-ups coming out of the penitentiary expected to come home and their family waiting for them to come save the day. And I'm yapping to myself. I'm late for a meeting because I got a whole story in my head. What are we talking about? Rehabilitation is in order. Not just, you didn't show up. Sorry for you. Why can't you get it together? You got folks coming home from prison that were on Z code. Does anybody here know what Z code is? Raise your hand. Can somebody what is Z code? Can somebody say it out loud? I'm sorry.
Alone.
Why are they alone? Why do you think that? So, right, or whatever, right? I mean, a lot of reasons.
Can't live with others. Killed their ex-roommate.
Sorry I went there, but I'm saying, hard cut. They home with their wife. I got a gentleman, and I'm not going to name names, obviously, that I talked him to 29 years in penitentiary. He's home, his wife thinks he's cheating on him because he's sleeping in the bathroom. She thinks she cheating. He talking to me. I'm not no therapist. I'm not no psychologist. There is an underlying, it's like a river rolling underneath our feet. And we're operating in our own world. Think we doing something. It's like staring at Kool-Aid and in the bottom, the sugar just looking at you like this. Sugar just looking. But yet that sugar, you want to go to the next slide? That sugar turned into this. In 90 days, what is this? 90, the bottom's a little cut off. 90 days, 3.5 months, 25%. And that ain't my numbers. Y'all can take it up with whoever did the research. Yeah, so we can talk about environments where people come at home to, and we know the demographics. And one thing I haven't mentioned in this whole conversation is race and any kind of cultural elements that goes along with that, or not cultural, but just adaptations to environments and all that. I ain't talking about all that. I'm talking about how we get people mentally ready, at minimum, admitting and acknowledging the trauma that they've been through and the brain change that's been happening, and then get them support before and after. Huh? What are we talking about here? You go to the next slide. Yeah, and then we're talking about suicide. Let's talk about that. Not even talking about how many times someone coming home is more likely to commit suicide, but we're talking about 6 times as likely to shoot and kill somebody than the average, than a comparable demographic. Or be shot and killed. Same group. We ain't talking about a whole bunch of, right? All I'm saying, and again, that what I'm referring to isn't the be all end all. This is a very complex situation. But one thing I do know, I ain't getting no therapy coming home. I had to go to my old heads. And whatever he had is all I got. And I ain't getting no more. I was so fortunate to have film. Film gave me an opportunity. I never filled a job application out. I ain't got no high school diploma. I haven't had to have any of that. I had a skill set. That skill changed my life. It gave me exposures. And exposure is the name of the game. Real exposure. Not exposure like, I want you to take my position. I have a nonprofit. I just want you to come and give you these little penny-ante exposures. No. How do I give people power? We're talking about people that have been without power, deprived of power. The idea is that when you're talking about an institution where somebody has to come and ask for a pass to go down a, and I get regulation, I get all of that, but understand what that's doing to a human brain. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, and I get it. It's natural within the structure, and you got that safety and control, care and control. That's cool. Where's the care? The care should be in the instance of how do we get people knowing, if I know this has been the experience of this human brain, that I created a, because of they're in here, because they got to get institutionalized, because they got a place to take you when you ain't institutionalized. You know where that place is? Where's that place? What do they call it? They call it the Poconos, you know, right? Where's the Poconos, all right? The hole. Right? So you have to be institutionalized. You got to get with the program. You have to internalize the program. What time is anybody just going out of penitentiary? What time is count? They ain't got to answer. I ain't putting nobody on the spot. They know what time count is. You'll wake up dead in the middle of your sleep, 5 o'clock and more, be on that gate like this. What? 5 o'clock in the morning, right. So it becomes really internalized. It's powerlessness. I remember there was an instance with Rob and me. Rob came and dealt with a situation I was having with respect to parole years ago. Either way, I remember Rob coming in to advocate for me when I was in the dead right and I was apologetic to them. We go in there, Rob said, "This is absurd," you know, and Rob went. He came in with all his privilege. He just come in that joint. I'm saying, "Rob, leave this shit alone. Parole is a privilege." And that's that. I ain't gonna say the name of the person or the position. Don't you say it either. They're not there anymore anyways, but you know. I get in there. Rob's already, he's red. He, this is, man, we just came out with Pull of Gravity. We got all these screenings all over the country. I mean, all over the country. We screened 400 plus times of this film. Oh, we was flying back and forth. I couldn't go nowhere. Rob said, he called me and said, "Ain't you just surprised? Ain't you just happy? Like, this is amazing." Good for you, Rob. I can't go nowhere, unfortunately. I got a little situation. It's all cool. Now, what's the situation? Rob, it's cool. Next thing you know, what happens? Rob gets the meeting. I go into the office. First thing, before anything else, I go in there and say, "Listen, I apologize for Rob. Rob's a friend. He don't understand what this is." And the guy looked and says, "I hear you, Mr. Sawyer. Mr. Reed, is there anything else?" This whole conversation. This ain't paraphrasing. This is it. I come in there. "Assalamu alaikum. There ain't no problems here. No problem. Rob just is a friend. He's acting as a friend. No problems." He said, "Mr. Reed, is there anything else?" Rob says, "No, are you going to deal with this?" Or like, "Yeah, I'll deal with it. I'll deal with it, Rob. It's cool." I said, "Just..." Rob leaves. "All right, we're good now, right? We're good, Rob. Thank you, man." They call me every name in the book. Oh. This is people's experience that they know. This is the learned powerlessness that we have to identify. And what did I do the whole time? This guy's spitting on me. Like you ain't that. Like, all that action. This is real. This happened. What'd I do? Just let me out that door. That's all. Don't take me back to that penitentiary. Powerlessness. Not power. Insisted, learned powerlessness. It wasn't until, again, just over the time of just feeling like, I don't have to call nobody if I travel. So I don't have to, like, becoming a man and becoming like, and you know, when I lock my doors now. Because the day before I got off parole, somebody's in my house searching my house for drugs. My wife's like, "What is going on?" The day before I got off parole, I was on parole for 12 years. No infractions. 12 years. And name somebody that did that. There's a Bruce Perry quote. This guy, Bruce Perry, is a renowned psychologist. And he says, we look at resilience like a Nerf ball. Like you squeeze it and it pops back into in the regular shape. Ain't that how we look at people going to prison? Like they just had to change their address. All they knew just is come home and then here's this list of things and you're going to be good. You know, just stay home. Nothing happened. We just, all we got to do is just be free. We're cool. We just need a job. Get a, here's an ID. Cool, you off. Why didn't you, man? We got him an ID and everything. He went back to the penitentiary. He couldn't stop what he was, he, oh, it's more than a Nerf ball squeezing it and getting back to, he says, as opposed to looking at trauma as resilience to trauma, like a squeezing a Nerf ball, and if go back to regular shape, we should look at it as a wire hanger. We unravel it, and you could be the best wire hanger rapper in the world. It will never be the same again. Trauma is a, and he also goes on to say, trauma is a dirt road, and our job isn't to pave over that dirt road, because it ain't going anywhere. It's a lot of lived experience. Our job is to build a three-lane highway beside that dirt road. To me, that's the work y'all are doing in the best light. How do we build three-lane? How do we support folks in building three-lane highways? Identifying that there's a dirt road there, but building supportive mechanisms so people would have options and tools if they do dip onto that dirt road. Thank you.